Of all the indiscreet remarks made over the decade of our acquaintance by my friend, not one involved his family. Well, hey, good people, how you doing? This is Keith Toller, your volunteer broadcaster, bringing you the Mystery Hour, right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Truly grateful that you joined me. Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine and Terrence Faraday bring us our first story, and it's called The Greek Interpreter. Editor's note. Ever since its initial publication in the Strand magazine in 1893, The Greek Interpreter has been an important entry in the Sherlock Holmes canon because it introduces Holmes's older brother, Mycroft, who is described as smarter than the famous detective by no less than authority than the detective himself. It is, therefore, no exaggeration to say that the recent discovery of an earlier draft of the Greek Interpreter, written in Dr. Watson's own hand, has created an atmosphere of nervous anticipation among Sherlockians. Given how significantly the Sherlock Holmes of these early drafts differ from the hero of the stories Watson eventually published in the Strand, the expectation has been that the good doctor surely took liberties with Mycroft as well. Any uncertainty on this point is now at an end as we here present The Greek Interpreter in its original unredacted form. In keeping with our usual practice, the doctor's editing notes and words of encouragement to himself appear in the text in parentheses. Unless otherwise noted, all spelling has been changed to modern American usage. Of all the indiscreet remarks made over the decade by our acquaintance by my friend Sherlock Holmes while he was in the process of emptying a pint glass, not one involved his family. Given the number of pints the sleuthhound dispatched during this period, the omission struck me as odd, and even uncanny, so much so that I began to think of him as having sprung to life full-grown like Venus is said to have emerged from Jupiter's brow. Was it Venus? Diana? Best check this. Then one evening, to my surprise, great surprise, Holmes spoke of a brother. We were strolling between pubs, enjoying the particularly fine June weather. Our prior conversation had concerned the game of golf, and whether it resembled the higher attainments of mankind, in that reading a side hill putt required calculations resembling celestial mechanics, which was my position, or whether golf was in truth a throwback to a low period of human development involving, as it did, striking things with clubs, which was Holmes's position. Elevate the tone of this, if possible. Now we were debating whether proficiency in an activity came from inherited ability or from study. To support the latter position, I cited Holmes's prowess as a detective, which I had come to believe was due entirely to his own self-directed training.
"I dunno," he replied thoughtfully. "Certainly my people will country squires with nothing much going on in the brains department, but I do have an artistic relation on my mother's side."
"Oh," I said eagerly, "a painter from the continent, perhaps?"
"No, a porcelain decorator from Staffordshire. But any turpentine in the blood can throw a spanner into the old hereditary works."
"There's a bon mot in here somewhere. Dig for it."
"But what makes you think your deductive powers arise from hereditary?"
Because of my brother Mycroft, who hasn't had the advantage of what you're kind enough to call my training. Possess those same powers, though to a lesser degree."
"Your brother? Younger?"
No, older by 7 years, quite moss-covered, in fact.
But if he's your equal as a problem-solver...
Well, almost my equal.
Fine. If he is almost your equal, how is it that I have never heard of him?
Well, he is quite well known in his own circle.
I started to point out that everyone is quite well known in his own circle, that being the very definition of circle. But I checked myself, not wanting to irritate Holmes and perhaps miss the chance to hear more of this brother.
Where, for instance? I asked instead.
Well, at the Diogenes pub, where he often holds court.
I had never heard the name, and my face proclaimed my surprise. Holmes chuckled.
I know what you're thinking. Through me, you've become familiar with many, well, far too many, of London's pubs. Why not, then, the Diogenes? Well, for one thing, it's a bit of a hole. For another, it caters to odd birds like Mycroft, men who fit in nowhere, but nevertheless feel the need to rub elbows now and then. Also, the pub's bitter is risible, as it is brown ale. Its porter is passable, though, more than passable.
He consulted his watch.
If you'd like, I'd be willing to introduce you to the Diogenes and to Mycroft as well. By a happy chance, our tour this evening has carried us well eastward. We've only a little farther to go.
After we'd walked 5 minutes in silence, my companion said,
Now you're wondering why my brother never became a detective.
Actually, I'd been musing on the Diogenes pub's passable porter, and occasionally moistening my lips, but I fell in with Holmes's suggestion.
The answer, he continued, is that Mycroft is far too lazy. He would never stir from a comfortable armchair to do any kind of keyhole peeping that pays so many of a detective's bills.
How does he earn a living?
As a clerk for the Bank of England. Numbers are and always have been his passion. He has rooms near Treadneedle Street, where, as you know, the bank is located. The only other stop on Mycroft Holmes' line is the Diogenes pub, which isn't far from his rooms.
Again, Holmes became thoughtful.
My brother's facility with figures is another bar to his success as a detective. He has a tendency to see problems in mathematical terms rather than human ones. It isn't that he lacks any knowledge of his fellows. He's a dab hand at telling a man's profession from his thumbs. But he's seen too much of life from his teller's window and not enough from street level. Even as a youth, he wouldn't bother himself to read the literature of his own civilization, which might have given him the grounding in human nature he is too diffident to obtain first hand.
The evening light was finally fading, just when we most needed it, as we had arrived at the head of a dimly lit side street. It was made up of buildings so black with soot that they might have been the survivors of the Great Fire. In their midst was a public house whose sign featured a robed and bearded man holding a lamp at arm's length. The interior of the pub was low-ceilinged and smoky as a consequence. A few of the odd birds Holmes had mentioned were in attendance, but they were far from flocking, each having placed himself as far from the others as the span of the bar permitted. We disturbed this arrangement long enough to procure our porter, which was served in battered tankards. Then Holmes led me to a far corner, so set off by paneled half-walls as to constitute a separate room. As we approached it, I could hear a deep voice intoning something about the Bank Charter Act of 1844. The voice belonged to a man who was remarkably fat, corpulent. In fact, the broad chair in which he reclined had no match in the Diogenes, so far as I could see, and therefore must have been reserved for him. If not actually made to his measure, in spite of the speaker's girth, the features of his face possessed some of the hawkish character of my friend's, and his eyes were a familiar piercing gray. Seated on either side of the massive chair were two drinkers, well along in their evening's work, and listening with apparent fascination to the large man's lecture on England and the gold standard. That lecture broke off the second the lecturer noted us.
"Well, Sherlock, my lad, what a pleasant surprise."
I thought I detected my companion stiffen at being thus addressed, and in a booming voice, but his reply was congenial.
"Mycroft, you're looking well,"
he added, "fed," to me in a stage whisper.
"And this must be your publicist, Dr. Watson. It isn't safe to open a newspaper since you took up your cause. Just last week I read that you have consulted in the Settlement House matter. I expected you to consult me in turn."
"No, I cracked it."
"It was Aikens, wasn't it?"
"Yes,"
I blurted out, which won me an elbow to the ribs from Holmes.
"I thought as much. Sherlock often chides me for my sedentary ways, Doctor, but I find the Diogenes sufficient. Though itself a quiet pool, it is constantly refreshed by the great river of life. Wilkins," he nodded toward the tosspot to his left, "is a regular and well known to me, but this other gentleman is a stranger. What can you tell me of him, Sherlock?"
"He's a billiard marker by trade."
"Was a billiard marker," Mycroft corrected. "He lost his place last,
here he sniffed the air genteelly,
"Saturday."
"The pocketbook he carries is not his own," Holmes observed, "and he recently deserted his wife and child."
"Oh, children, my dear boy, children."
At this point, the subject of the experiment scurried off. Mycroft appeared not to notice.
"Your arrival is fortuitous, Sherlock. I've had something come my way that is more in your line of country, if you would care to hear about it."
"Oh, you're asking for my help?"
"Only, perhaps, to run an errand or two."
"In that case, you can—"
"Tell us all about it," I cut in, before blood or worse, porter could be spilled. "I'll do better than that, Doctor."
Mycroft then addressed his remaining audience members.
"Wilkins, would you be so kind as to step out and see if Mr. Moodis is with us this evening?"
Wilkins hurried away. Weaving between invisible obstacles, he returned escorting a bearded gentleman who would have seemed plump in any company but Mycroft's.
"Oh, thank you, Wilkins. Please, have something on me at the bar."
When his minion was out of earshot, Mycroft introduced the newcomer to his brother.
Thank you for being willing to hear my sad tale. Please be seated, gentlemen, for it is not a short one. The police quite tired of me before I'd half finished. They did not believe such a thing could happen in their London, but I swear it did. I cannot rest until I know what has befallen the prisoner in the sticking plaster mask.
Oh, look at the time," Holmes said, making to rise from the chair he just only occupied.
"Patience, Sherlock," Mycroft intoned. "I should say, by way of preamble, that Mr. Moodis has a remarkable gift for languages. He grew up an orphan in the worst quarter of Athens." "A child of the streets, were you not?"
"It is true," Moodis said. "A mere urchin."
"When still not grown to manhood, he found himself in Paris, where he resided for some years, again living by his wits. Finally, he came to London. His experiences have made him a linguist of note, and he earns his bread and beer as an interpreter and as a guide to foreigners visiting our capital."
Mundus was nodding with vigor.
"I interpret many languages, but my specialty, true to my name, is Greek. That specialty figures in the sad story I must now tell. Last Monday evening at 7 o'clock, I received a caller in my rooms. Such a visit was not unusual, as I am available at all hours to aid foreigners in need. This particular caller, who gave his name as Massiter, was dressed like a toff, which was reassuring. He told me he had urgent business to conduct with a Greek national who spoke no English. I readily agreed to accompany him to Kensington in the cab he had waiting at. At least, Mr. Massiter called it a cab. When we were inside it, I saw that it was a private carriage, richly appointed. The discrepancy disturbed me, but before I could work up the nerve to ask about it, two far more troubling things occurred. The first was Mr. Massiter producing from his pocket a... what is the term? A life preserver?
A blackjack, I asked.
A bludgeon, Mycroft suggested.
A kosh, Holmes murmured.
Moodus shuddered.
I admire the wonderful variety of English words, he said, except perhaps in the area of weaponry. Mr. Massiter proceeded to swing this instrument back and forth within an inch of my knees in a threatening manner. When he tired of this, he tossed it onto the seat beside him and raised both windows of the carriage. Imagine my astonishment and fear when I saw that the window glass was covered in heavy paper.
It might inconvenience me were you to find your way to my home again, Mr. Massiter explained, as though his conduct was perfectly normal. When I pointed out that it was not normal or even legal, he shrugged.
You will be compensated accordingly. If you should call out or otherwise trouble me, you may expect to be compensated for that as well.
He had a quiet but forceful manner of speech, which left me in no doubt about the seriousness of my situation. I resolved, therefore, to do nothing rash, but to concentrate instead on listening for clues to our route from the passing traffic and from the pavement beneath our wheels. Alas, we drove for 2 hours, which time I had quite lost track of the sequence of cobbled and asphalt streets, and where I'd heard laughter and music, and where I'd heard train whistles and tower clocks. When the carriage finally came to a halt and Mr. Massiter opened its door, I had a fleeting glimpse of a lawn and trees. Then I was bundled out of the vehicle and through an arched doorway above which a lantern hissed and flared. The door was held open by a middle-aged woman who, from her bearing and dress and the silver in her hair, might have been someone's grandmother. Whatever hope the sight of her gave me was dashed when she burst into cackling laughter.
"Mr. Moodus, is it? Excellent work, Herschel, excellent. No bumps or bruises?
No, nor will there be if you mind your manners. If you don't..." There she cackled again like a pantomime. "Witch, no power on earth will save you." I asked in a shameful stammer what I was to do.
"You're to present our questions to a certain Greek gentleman and then present his answers to us. That much and no more. We have been in negotiations with him for some time, but our previous interpreter was obliged to return to Greece."
I would have happily joined him there if I'd been able. Instead, I was pushed into a room as richly appointed as Mr. Massiter's carriage and as poorly lit. Only one lamp served the large chamber, and that one so turned down as to smoke. Even so, I will know the room again if I see it, for there was a tall mantelpiece whose white marble shone as faintly as the setting moon, and above it a grinning African mask. A chair stood beside the lamp table. By pointing to it with a gnarled finger, the old woman instructed me to sit. It was then I noticed that Mr. Massiter had left us. I thought of running for the front door, but feared that even reaching the chair might be beyond me. That was just as well, as a door different from the one by which I'd entered opened, and Mr. Massiter came into the dim light, leading a piteous figure.
It was a man, tall but very thin, and clad in a dressing gown. His face sent a thrill of horror through me that I seemed to feel still. It was an unnatural white that glowed in the smoky light in the manner of the marble fireplace. When he drew closer, I saw that he wore a mask made up of sticking plasters, randomly but thoroughly applied. All I could see of his actual features were his eyes, which were bright with fever. His mouth was completely covered. "Did you remember the slate, Herschel?" the old woman asked. "Good, good. Bring that chair over here to face Mr. Mundus. Closer. Good. Now sit him down." The last instruction was unnecessary, as the prisoner fell into the empty chair without urging. Mr. Massiter thrust the slate into his hands and, with a piece of chalk with it. "Good," said the old woman. "You'll ask him my questions, Mr. Mundus, and then read off his answers."
Here Mundus paused and looked at each of us in turn. Then he said,
"I was near to fainting, and often during this horrible night, but never more so than at that moment."
I looked from Holmes to Mycroft for an explanation and found that Mycroft was staring intently at his brother. Then the detective said,
"You are illiterate, or very nearly so, so why didn't you simply tell them?" "For fear that the prisoner was not just forbidden to speak, but unable to. If that was so, and if my captors then found out my difficulties with the written word, I would be of no use to them. So I prayed that a few Greek words I can read would be enough. I had little time to think in any case before the old woman instructed me to ask the prisoner whether he could sign the papers. Luckily, I saw his answers in his flashing eyes, because the word he wrote meant nothing to me. 'Never,' I told her. 'On no conditions?' she asked, and I translated. The prisoner wrote a long reply. The only words I knew were sea and Greek priest. So I said, 'He would like to see an Orthodox priest.' The old woman cackled with pleasure. 'You know your fate, then?' He shrugged before writing his reply, and I translated the gesture. 'I care not.' Those were the questions and threats I put to the poor prisoner. The threats varied, but the question was always, 'Will you sign?' The answers became more and more difficult for me to decipher, for the man's strength was failing. But one word I recognized again, and again, it was sister. Finally, I decided to risk everything to learn the unfortunate's name. I asked him to write it plainly. His eyes darted to his tormentors, and I read his meaning clearly. 'They will recognize it.' At once I hit upon a stratagem. I told him to write as the first word of his next answer the last half of his name, and as the last word of the first half. In that way, I learned the name I will never forget. Capsalis. I'd no sooner won my prize than the door I had used to enter the room opened, and a young woman strode in. She was tall, with flowing black hair and the grace of a dancer, her movements accentuated by the loose white gown she wore. 'Herschel,' she said in an accent that took me back to Athens, 'I'm tired of... Oh, God, is it Paul? What are you two doing?' Like my captors, I had turned toward the speaker. Now a gurgling noise caused me to look back to the prisoner. As I watched, he tore the plaster from his lips and shouted, 'Medea, Medea!' He jumped to his feet with what must have been the last of his strength and rushed toward the newcomer.
In another second, they would have been in each other's arms, but for Mr. Massiter. He blocked the prisoner's path, and then all but carried him from the room. The crone led the woman in white through the other exit, gently crooning words I could not make out. I was alone but for a moment only. Then the old woman returned, muttering, "Well, that didn't work out for us." Noticing me, she added, "No fault of yours, though, Mr. Moodus, so here is your fee." She handed me 4 golden sovereigns. 2 are for your professional services, and 2 are for keeping your gob shut. If you should fail to do that, if you should speak to a single human soul about what you've seen tonight, Herschel will retrieve those 2 with a knife.
A knife?
Yes, she said, poking me in the stomach. You see, before he retrieves the coins, he'll make you swallow them. Once again she cackled like a triumphant hen, and my head swam. And don't tell yourself that we don't know you talked. I'll always know. I'll read it in the burning coals.
Here Moodus paused, breathless. I asked Holmes,
"Burning coals?"
"Yes, Watson, if I'm correct, she was proclaiming to be a practitioner of anthromancy, the ancient art of divination that uses burning coals in place of the more conventional crystal ball. The name derives, I believe, from the Greek word for charcoal."
"Yes," Moodus said. "The word is anthrax."
"My, my, Sherlock," Mycroft said. "The useless things, you know, and to think, Doctor, I used to have to help him with his sums. Finish your story, please, Mr. Moodus, or have you?"
"Almost. After I'd been threatened, Mr. Massiter took me for another ride in the carriage, again with the windows covered. This time we only rode for an hour before my host, who had been tapping his foot and muttering under his breath the whole time, ran out of patience. He ordered the driver to stop, opened the door, and kicked me out into the darkness. I found myself on a rural road. I might have passed the night there but for the timely arrival of a railroad custodian, only slightly the worse for drink. He directed me to the Chapham Junction station and a train to Victoria. I told my story to the police that very night, but they didn't believe a word of it. Then, still later, I told Mr. Mycroft."
Holmes added, "Who failed to consult me, it was only the merest chance that brought me here tonight."
Mycroft shrugged ponderously.
"What could be done has been done. I instituted inquiries at the Greek legation. They've never heard of a Paul Capsalis. And I ran this advertisement in the afternoon papers."
He took a clipping from the pocket of his vast waistcoat and read from it.
"Reward offered for news of a Greek national named Paul Capsalis, who speaks no English, also for a Greek lady whose first name is Medea. There has been, as yet, no answer."
"I'm afraid," Holmes said, "that the answer will come directly to Mr. Moodus, at the point of a knife."
"What do you mean?" Moodus stammered.
"Only that you might as well swallow those sovereigns now and get it over with. My brother's advertisement has almost certainly informed your late captors that you've preached."
"What am I to do?"
"Stay far away from your rooms this night. Have you friends from whom you can borrow a sofa?"
"None."
"Then Mycroft will put you up."
"What?" the brother protested.
"That way I'll know where to find you both. Expect to hear from me tomorrow, gentlemen."
With that, Holmes led me out into the night. Due to the late hour and the length of our earlier walk, we elected to return to Baker Street by hansom. As our cabbie urged his horse into motion, I said to my companion,
However did you figure out that Mudus is illiterate?
Holmes chuckled.
I'm used to the little tests and traps Mycroft sets for me, and I suspected that his lecture on Mudus's background was just a snare. An intelligent child with a good ear who'd grown up on the streets of two very cosmopolitan capitals, as Mudus did, might well speak a number of languages, but he'd have a much harder time learning to read them. Then there was the fact that Mudus makes his living as an interpreter and guide rather than as a translator, which would require the ability to read and write.
Still, I said, illiterate polyglots must be incredibly rare.
On the contrary, they are quite common in India, where you did your army service.
I saw that Holmes, still tingling with sibling rivalry from his encounter with Mycroft, would argue the point till dawn, so I gave it up. Our journey was broken then, in any case, when Holmes spied an all-night telegraph office. While I waited in the cab, he dispatched a wire to the Greek police. The text, which he shared when we were rattling along again, was,
"Send any information regarding Greek national Paul Capsalis and his sister."
"You believe that the word sister Mundus spotted in the prisoner's reply referred to the lady in white?"
"Very likely."
"Holmes, I think I see the whole plot. The sister, while on a visit to England, came under the power of this Bounder Massiter. Unbeknownst to her, Massiter then imprisoned the brother when he showed up in England searching for her. Now he's trying to force the brother to sign over his sister's inheritance."
Holmes' only reply was,
"So what did you think of the porter?"
I fumed in silence until I spotted an important omission Holmes had made in his telegram to Athens. Important because it gave me the chance to tweak his strong-set aquiline nose.
"Holmes," I asked, "why didn't you include the first name of Capsalis's sister in your inquiry to the Athens police?"
"For the very good reason that I don't know her first name." "Ah, home at last."
I got no more from the detective that night or the next morning. He left me at noon, promising to be back in an hour or two. In the event, darkness was falling, and I was in the process of lighting the gas when he returned.
"No luck?" I asked.
"No, on the contrary. I found every answer I sought. Any reply from Athens?" "No? Well, I think we can carry on without it."
"You succeeded at the Greek legation, where Mycroft failed?"
"No, I appealed to a higher authority."
"The Foreign Office?"
"The Greek Orthodox Church, old fellow. More specifically, the Church on the Holy Wisdom in Bayswater. That course of action was suggested to me when Mr. Mudus told of the prisoner asking to see a priest. While I'm certain Mudus muddled that translation, the idea of a Greek national seeking out his or her mother church while in London seemed a perfectly natural one."
The growler of beer I'd bought that afternoon drew Holmes like a steel to a magnet. He pulled the cork and sniffed it.
"Porter again? Oh, well. Will you join me?"
As he poured, he resumed his report.
"I inquired at our principal Greek Orthodox Church Holy Wisdom, and learned that both Capsalis and his sister, whose name is Sophia, by the way, visited the church at different times, the sister to ask for a wedding to be performed, the brother to ask after the sister."
"Slow down," I protested. "If the girl's name is Sophia, why did Paul address her as Medea?"
Holmes sighed.
"Oh, I see your background in classical literature is no better than Mycroft's. Medea is a character from Greek mythology. She's the woman who fell in love with a seagoing bounder named Jason and helped him steal her family's great treasure, the Golden Fleece, in process murdering her very own brother. Sound familiar?"
the scales fell from my eyes, metaphorically speaking. Then when Paul called her Medea, he was accusing her of being in league with Masseter. What Mundus mistook for an attempt to embrace her must have been an attempt to assault her.
Exactly. I've no doubt that Sophia had been in on her brother's ordeal from the start. She was probably the first interpreter, the one who supposedly returned to Greece. I suspect her confederates, simply tired of her failure to win her brother's cooperation, and decided to try on their own using a neutral interlocutor, Mudus. Sophia's untimely entrance cut short their attempt.
Today, at Holy Wisdom, I spoke with the vicar and learned that Sophia had asked him to officiate at her wedding to an Englishman. The priest had refused because Sophia lacked the approval of her nearest male relation, which is a requirement under their customs.
Was that the paper the villains wanted Capsellis to sign?
Possibly. We'll know more when we visit the Myrtles in Beckenham, where Sophia and her intended reside. Learning that took me hours of visits with the most prominent gossips of Holy Wisdom's congregation. I was forced to drink countless cups of tea and eat some abominably sweet cakes, but eventually I pieced together the story. Sophia was on a visit to London when she fell in love with Masseter. His real name? Herschel Barnard. He lives with his mother at the aforementioned manse in Beckenham. If you drew a line on a map between London and Beckenham, it would pass through Clapham Junction, where Mudus was discarded.
Oh, well done!
All that remains is to effect...
effect?
A rescue. We'll need a policeman, I think.
And possibly an interpreter, I said. We'd best stop by your brother's for Mudus.
Splendid idea. We can dragoon Mycroft at the same time. A little trip to the country will do him a world of good.
We collected first a four-wheeler, and then a quavering Mudus and a grumbling Mycroft. Securing our policeman took far longer. Holmes insisted on Gregson, the one policeman of his acquaintance who never demanded a share of Holmes's fees. The inspector's scrupulousness was almost our undoing, however, as Gregson would not move without a warrant, and obtaining one consumed much valuable time. To make up that time, we took a train to Beckenham, which inspired additional complaining from Mycroft, who wasn't built for train seats or aisles or, come to that, anything short of a luggage van. From the Beckenham station, we proceeded by an open carriage, nearly coming to grief on a country lane, where we encountered a heavily loaded dray. The Myrtles, when we reached it, showed a single light, a gas lamp above the front door that hissed and sputtered in the exact fashion Mudus had described. We found the unlocked house to be deserted. The only sign of recent habitation were a few embers of a charcoal fire in a small brass tripod.
"Mrs. Barnard wasn't kidding about the anthromancy," Holmes observed. "Maybe it really works."
"However they foresaw our coming," I said, "they are gone bag and baggage."
"Bag and baggage?" Holmes repeated, then clapped me on the shoulder, unfortunately the one wounded in Afghanistan. "Watson, you're invaluable. To the carriage, gentlemen."
We retraced our route, Holmes urging on our driver until we again sighted the heavily loaded wagon. As we closed on it, Gregson stood up and shouted,
"Stop in the name of the law!"
His powerful voice rang through the night, frightening the dray's team. The horses bucked and pulled against the teamsters' best efforts to quiet them, until at last they shifted the biggest object on the wagon's bed, a massive trunk. The box landed with a crash on the packed earth. Holmes sprang from our carriage. When he reached the trunk, he bent his ear to it.
"Yes? Definitely moaning," he said. "We must break it open."
We did so using an iron pry bar provided by the baffled wagoneers. Inside the trunk was a thin man, gagged and bound hand and foot. On his face were still pieces of sticking plaster, no longer white. When his gag was removed, he emitted a string of angry words, which Mutis translated as,
"Need you have called out so abruptly? They dropped me on my head."
While I examined him, the Greek confirmed, through his translator, all of Holmes's deductions. Though weak and shaken, Capsalis proved to be in no immediate danger. So we left him and Mutis with a local physician. Holmes and Gregson and I then dashed about, trying unsuccessfully to pick up the trail of the Bernards and Sophia. Mycroft exempted himself from this process, claiming fatigue, though I suspected that he'd seen all he cared to of his younger brother's triumph. Much later, Holmes and I found ourselves in Beckenham's oldest pub, whose blackened timbers had been decorated with initials and dates spanning centuries. There I raised a glass, not containing porter, to my friend and repeated the words I'd used back at Baker Street.
"Well done!"
Holmes, who had been studying the sovereigns Mutis had thrust upon him, smiled wearily.
"Well, it was worth it just to send Mycroft off in a bad humor. Still, I wish we'd bagged the Bernard gang."
"Well, perhaps Gregson will yet run them to earth."
"Yes, perhaps."
"I must admit," I said, "that I fear for poor Sophia. In spite of her ill treatment of her brother, I hate to think of her in the company of that cackling woman and her evil son."
"If I were you," Holmes replied, "I'd be more worried about the hen and her chick. I didn't tell you how the story of Medea ends. After the fleece snatching, she and Jason married and started a family. Then Jason left her for the daughter of a king whose throne he fancied. I won't ruin your sleep by describing the mayhem that ensued. I'll only say that I wouldn't be surprised to read of Herschel's dying by his own knife, should he ever play poor Sophia false."
Okie doke. I've switched over to a different issue of the Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine, and I'm going to read a story by Arizona author Twist Phelan, I believe she is. The title of the story is Artificial Hearts. Kayla checked her phone. He'd replied already. She pasted his response from the dating app into the app, trademark, the new artificial intelligence application, and instructed, "Answer this in a flirty way, but make me sound smart. Include a pun." The text appeared almost immediately. Kayla copied it into the dating app, sent it, and then typed another request into the app, trademark. "Choose and touch up my best photo from last weekend, just a little, not full Kardashian." Two images appeared, an original and an enhanced version of the same shot. Kayla sent the latter and smiled. She turned 25 2 months ago. Most of her friends were engaged or married. A few were even having babies. Burned out on dating apps that took her time, money, and energy while delivering hookups instead of love, Kayla had been about to give up on ever finding someone special. Then a friend told her about the app. "It does everything," the friend said, "perfectly." Her friend was right. The app not only edited Kayla's profile and tweaked her photos, It scoured the dating app for profiles that matched her criteria. Rich, 6 foot or taller, no fantasy football bros. Dispensing with those who reached out but fell short, polite turndowns for guys who weren't a good fit, deletion for fake accounts, married dudes, and bots. And best of all, composing communication to the men she liked, customizing them so well each guy couldn't help but fall for her. Like Rory, her fave name, had. They'd been chatting for 2 weeks. While their convos were perfect, he got her sense of humor. His photos alone told Kayla he was who she was looking for. She'd even broken her rule and liked some of his pictures first, freaking out until he reciprocated. Rory drove a new Tesla, X-Plaid, not the 3, wore James Persay tees and All Saints denim, had a dog the same breed as her mini, the dog's name was Mickey, Destiny, and lived in Miami. The city everyone knew was her dream birthday destination. Today, they were finally going to meet. Kayla hadn't wanted to do it virtually. It was more romantic to feel a first spark in person. Rory agreed. His flight arrived in 2 hours. They were meeting at Red Rocks, his suggestion. The local trend bloggers had it as a top 10 Denver date spot for a picnic. He was bringing the basket, total meat cute. The app hadn't just upgraded Kayla's love prospects. Her boss had taken notice since Kayla started using the app to write her presentations and reports. The app told her how to score tickets to sold-out concerts. The clothes the app ordered fit her budget and looked fab. Kayla couldn't imagine living without the app. Every aspect of her life it touched was made better. She looked in the mirror, adjusted a strand of hair, and paused. What if Rory wasn't who he appeared to be? What if he was using the app too? Kayla stared at her reflection for a moment, then went back to fixing her hair. Even with the app's little tweaks, Rory was probably the real deal, too. What was the point in totally lying? Her phone buzzed, a reminder from the app that it was time for her to leave for her date. Kayla checked her makeup and her hair one last time, feeling a surge of anticipation. "He's the one," she told her reflection. She was about to drop her phone into her bag when she had an idea. The app knew everything about her and Rory. Didn't that mean it could also tell if they were truly a match? She opened the app and typed, "Should I marry Rory?" "As an AI application, I am unable to make personal decisions." Dale, aka Rory, the app's suggestion, got out of his Toyota and stretched. It was a 10-hour drive from Des Moines to Denver. The app's plan for Kayla, point number 3, tell her you're flying and then drive. But he'd added a 2-hour detour to Kansas City. The app plan for Kayla, point number 5, never shop for special items in the state where you live. Where the app steered him to cameraless gas stations and stores that stocked what he needed. The app planned for Kayla, point 8. Bring condoms, duct tape, zip ties, latex gloves, poncho, plastic sheeting, box cutter, trash bags, picnic basket. Eagerness ran through him. Thanks to the app, Dale finally had a strategy. No more messaging a girl only to be ghosted or dumped before he could set up a date and live out his fantasy, the one that had been building in his brain until he thought it would burst. This time, he had let the app ID a target and take over. The app combed Kayla's social media for likes, dislikes, and interests. It created a profile for Rory designed to appeal specifically to her. Rory reached out to Kayla, winning her over with the app's generated messages. And once Kayla agreed to meet, the app had devised the plan for Kayla. Dale got back in the car, 90 minutes until the meeting at Red Rocks. He'd lost 11 pounds per the app's instructions, had his teeth capped by a dentist chosen by the app, gotten the haircut the app suggested, and worn the clothes the app recommended. Still, he felt nervous. What if Kayla took off when she saw him in person? He typed the question into the app. Will Kayla nope out after we meet? As an AI application, I cannot predict the future with certainty. Arjun set his coffee and vending machine change on his desk, opened his laptop, and fired up the app's activity feeds. They were in the final stage of beta testing, and he didn't want anything to go wrong in the control user group that would jeopardize the next round of funding. He was especially concerned about a couple meeting for the first time, Kayla and Dale. Like everyone else who downloaded the app, they either hadn't noticed or didn't care that the terms and conditions permitted the app's developer, Arjun, to access all their online activity. All meant all. Kayla's texts to girlfriends about her new perfect man and her visits to wedding planning sites. Dale's orders of books about serial killers and his electronic receipts for yesterday's purchases. Their convos on the dating app, most of which had been generated by Arjun's creation. He checked Dale's GPS location. 20 minutes to go. At first, Arjun had felt like a spy, even a stalker, when he reviewed the online activity, the app's subscribers. Now he saw himself as an analyst, observing how people used the app so he could make the program better. 19 minutes. Should I call Kayla? The thought caught him unawares. Kayla and Dale were adults, in charge of their actions and responsible for their consequences. And Kayla might ditch Dale at first sight. Or Dale might lose his nerve or change his mind. It wasn't Arjun's place to interfere. Besides, if he called Kayla and it got out would-be serial killers were using the app, bye-bye VC funding, bye-bye Arjun's company, including the seed money his parents had provided from their retirement account, bye-bye working in tech ever again. Even if no one else other than Kayla knew, Dale might still be able to sue him personally for defamation. Arjun passed a hand over his face. No, he had to stay out of it. Arjun stared at the moving dot that represented Dale on the map. 17 minutes. But what if I read about her in the news tomorrow? 16 minutes. The question buzzed around his brain like a belligerent wasp. He needed to make it stop. Arjun opened the app on his phone and dictated, "Should I call Kayla? As an AI application, I need additional information on this situation and people involved to provide a meaningful answer to your question." Arjun grimaced. The app had a devastating sense of humor, a stunning capacity for information synthesis, and could edit any photo to make it irresistible. But it became as circumspect as a U.S. Supreme Court nominee during a confirmation hearing when asked for its opinion. The app understood the statistical correlation between words, not the concepts underlying them. It lacked morals. It was a shortcoming Arjun and his lead programmer were working on. Arjun wanted to input more scenario outcomes. If X is done, then Y outcome will occur Z percent of the time. The lead programmer thought the best way to instill ethics in the app was by adding novels to its database. Storytelling is a fundamental part of being human, he'd said. we should start with college lit syllabuses. Arjun had agreed, not wanting to admit he'd hardly read any fiction in school or since. He'd failed high school English and taken only tech courses his first semester at university, dropping out after that to start his company. Any free time he spent on gaming. His eyes went to the map. 14 minutes. Should I call Kayla? Arjun pressed his fingers to his temples, feeling his pulse throb. By law, tech companies were largely shielded from liability for the content posted on their sites. Neither he nor his company would be expected to be the supervisor, no, the protector, of every The App customer. Kayla and Dale had decided to use The App to get what they wanted. Whatever happened would be on them. 11 minutes. Should I call Kayla? Shut up, shut up! Arjun muttered. His gaze darted around the room, stopping at a mock-up of The App. He could call his head programmer. With shaking fingers, he scrolled to the number. The call went straight to a voicemail. He checked the map. 7 minutes. Should I call Kayla? Arjun raked a hand through his hair. It was a simple question. The app had to know the answer. He hit regenerate response. As an AI application, I cannot advise what action to take in a specific situation. I do not have a conscience. You don't need a conscience. Just use the data, Arjun screamed. He checked the app. 3 minutes. Arjun flung his phone onto the desk, knocking over his coffee and scattering his change. He stared at the coins. That's it? Relief rushed through him as he grabbed a quarter. With a flick of his thumb, he sent it spinning into the air. Heads, he'd call Kayla. The coin landed on the floor and rolled under the desk. Arjun dropped to his knees and crawled after it, frantic to see which side was facing up. All right, folks, that's it for the Mystery Hour. This time here on Sunsounds, I thank you very much for tuning in. Join me again next time, would you please? Keith Tyler here saying, make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.